This is a Scoop election briefing. This is Kevin with Peter Dunn, the leader of the United Future Party. Okay, Peter, start off. What is the core goals of United Future when you came here in 2002? What's the core goal in 30 seconds of United Future?
Two things, really. We wanted to bring family policy back to centre stage of the political process, and we also wanted to be part of a government that would be the first to survive a full term under MMP, and we've achieved both.
Your previous party, United, in 1999, did they have similar goals?
Yes, it did. United and United Future are virtually indistinguishable in terms of their objectives. That was why the two parties came together. We were able to get the critical mass last time to get more than one MP elected, and we're able to therefore make progress on the things that are important to us.
Okay. Now, what was at the leaders' debate, the minor leaders' debate on Saturday, came across as quite centrist yourself. Do all the members of your party, are they all centrist?
Well, we've always said we're a centre party. We are, in fact, a quintessential centre party that can moderate the extremes of both sides, and that's really what we've set out to do in the last 3 years, and I think we've been successful in doing that.
Well, this election, though, it seems both Labor and National, probably Labor's gone more left and National's gone probably a bit more right than National under Bill English, would you agree?
Yes, I think so. And the irony is that that should have opened up space in the centre for other parties. But this election so far, if you believe the polls, has seen the two major parties getting over 80% of the vote, which is about 20-odd percent higher than they ever scored in the past. So that's one of the complications of this campaign.
Well, do you think it might make it more difficult when you choose which to go with? Because,
well, I think it's going to make it more difficult all round. There's still 2 and a bit weeks to go, and obviously the campaign is going to fire up a little bit more. But I don't think, in terms of our decision, I don't think it makes it any more or less difficult than it was last time. The contrast might be starker, but the issues are still the same.
It's just, I was also at the Business New Zealand seminar, and it seemed to me that Gordon Copeland, his policies definitely didn't have anything much, or United Future's policies obviously, didn't have much in common with
Labour. I think it's fair to say that our economic policies would be much more attuned to or able to be worked with under a National government than a Labour government. But equally, if you look at our policies in areas like education and health, social services, it's far more likely we could work with the Labour government. That's just the classic centrist position.
What about law and order, though?
Well, law and order, we've worked well with the Labour government up to a point. I mean, we got the victims' rights law through. It was one of our early triumphs. I know what you're going to say. Mark Alexander has expressed huge frustration.
Like Phil Goff.
Not with Phil Goff, I was going to say, but with some other members. I think the big blow for us was that we weren't able to retain the contract for the privately run prison in Auckland, and also Labour backed away in the end over the compensation for prisoners going to victims. So Mark's made some strong comments. Mark, of course, is a pretty hard-line law and order person. I think if the opportunity arose, while he may have a preference to work with National on law and order issues, I think he could work with Labour again too.
Well, see, this is what I'm coming to, though, because the party hopping law has disappeared as of now. So what is to stop? So hypothetically, you go with Labour, Mark Alexander goes, I can't handle this anymore.
Personal integrity. All of our candidates have given assurances that they will stay the distance.
Well, so did Alamein Kōpū, I presume.
Yeah, well, I wasn't ever involved with Alamein Kōpū. But personal integrity, and I think that's something that I would expect people to want.
Well, I'm not actually up to date with the legislation, but it is possible, isn't it? And I'm not saying that Mark Alexander would, it could be someone in another party, but once this party hopping law goes...
Well, it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone as of the dissolution of the Parliament.
So when you come back with 4, 8, 9 MPs...
There's no restriction.
No restriction.
No restriction on people leaving parties. Is it going to happen? I think it's going to be very unlikely, because I think we've gone through the transition to MMP, and that great period where people moved around was in that first 2 or 3 years. There will be the odd one in the future who will do it, as there was the odd one under the old system. But I think that we've got over the hump. It may well be that it's something that Parliament might want to reconsider, whether it reinstates the law. I've got an open mind on that.
I'd just like to take you back to the fact that Labour's gone more left and National's more right. Do you see this being a problem for you as a centrist party then, because some of your MPs might not be so in charge?
No, I don't. I see what you're saying. I don't see that as a huge problem. I think because both parties will have their own tensions. People at their, if you like, at the right wing of Labour and the left wing of National will be feeling equally twitchy about their party's lurches in other directions. So this is largely a self-correcting thing. There will be the odd occasion where someone spits the dummy. There always has been. I'm not expecting it to occur with any of our MPs, and probably not even during the term of this Parliament anywhere else, but there will be people who will do that in the future.
This week, the big news was National's race policy. Mm. What's United Futures' position on the Māori
seats?
Well,
we think that the future of the Māori seats does need to be debated. We think that a timetable needs to be discussed and agreed with Māori for their phasing out. We don't think you can do this by unilateral action, but we certainly think, building on the recommendations of the Royal Commission in 1986, that the Māori seats had had their day, that we ought to be having that debate and starting to work towards an agreed process for their phasing out.
In your top 9 or 10 MPs, is anyone with Māori heritage?
Yes, Bernie Ogilvie has a Māori, Māori background, and when he came here, in fact, his whanau and iwi came and handed him over formally to us.
So, I'm just noticing that because it's National's bottom line that they want to get rid of the Māori seats, and the Māori Party said we can't work with them, well, how do you deal with that particular issue?
Well, what the Māori Party says we don't have any interest in. Obviously, in terms of what the National Party is saying, maybe bottom lines it wants to bring to coalition negotiations, we'd be prepared to look at those and see whether we could, this is a give-and-take process, and we've got some bottom lines too.
Sure, but that's their bottom line, so...
Yeah. Well, Dr. Brash has also said that tax changes are a bottom line today, their tax policy. So I think in the heat of the pre-camp, pre-election manoeuvring, a lot of things are going to be said which will become far less immovable after the election when negotiations are actually taking place.
Well, except that when I was at Business New Zealand, there didn't seem to be a huge amount of difference between United Future and National over tax, other than the $10 that is paid under working families, according to Gordon Copeland.
There are some differences, but I've said that I don't think that they are hugely insurmountable. I think we could work our way through those quite easily. I've said that. I said that not at the Business New Zealand meeting, but I think at a meeting the day after.
But the abolishment of the Māori seats. It's pretty simple, it's pretty black and white. They either go or they stay, so what's your future?
Well, what I've said is that we think there should be a debate about a timetable for phasing them out, but that process has to occur in consultation with and with the support of Māori. You can't simply dispossess them. That doesn't mean we do nothing, it means we start the process. Now, what the National Party is saying is they want to abolish them. I think between the two positions there's some common ground that could be worked on.
What if they say we'd like to abolish them in 2 years?
Well, I think you then say, okay, if that's the objective, then you start a negotiation or a discussion process immediately to bring people on side to achieve that goal.
So I've noticed that Bernie Ogilvie, he's quite far down the party list, so he might not even be there. So you could theoretically be all Pākehā in United Future and you'd be voting with National to abolish the Māori seats. Would that be fair?
It's a theoretical possibility, but we haven't got to the election yet. We haven't even formed a government yet. So there are a number of big assumptions contained in that question.
Well, if you came back with 8 MPs, you wouldn't have anyone that was of Māori heritage. You'd then be going to vote
as far as I know, that may well be true, assuming we were working with National.
Would you be comfortable with that?
Well, as I say, these things you take one step at a time. You work your way through them. We haven't had any talks with National about what sort of a working arrangement we might have at any point in the future. That's the first thing that's got to occur. Then you start to say, what are the issues? What are potential sticking points? How might they be resolved? How important are they? I mean, the National Party says, for instance, that abolishing the Māori seats is a bottom line for it. But does that mean they want to do it in the first term, the first 1 year, the first 2 years? There are a whole lot of issues that flow from that.
I think it was actually the first term.
You work through those, and that's what negotiations are about.
Are you personally friendly with Helen Clark and Don Brash?
Yes, I've known Helen for probably a quarter of a century. Sounds a hell of a long time. I've worked well with her. We were both ministers in the 4th Labour government together. I've kept in touch with her in the intervening years. I've worked with her, obviously, very closely in the last 3 years. I've got a huge respect for her abilities and for her capacity. and I think in some senses we're not dissimilar. Don Brash I've known for 20 years as a friend, from the time that he was with the Kiwi Fruit Authority, long before he came to the Reserve Bank. And I get on well with him, I get on well with Helen, I can work with both.
Well, just on the topic of the emails that came out, do you believe that Don Brash was assisted in his race-based policy with...
I think he probably was, and some of the key characters have admitted as much. What's the significance of that at the end of the day? Well, I'm not sure. I think it's long bows to start suggesting there's some deep and dark conspiracy here. I mean, everyone gets all sorts of gratuitous offers flung their way. Some people provide more than just gratuitous advice. They provide practical help. Some don't. I think the interesting issue is why what looked to be his friends have now decided to leak all this material.
Well, you know Roger Douglas as well. You wouldn't know Roger Douglas. Roger Douglas sent Don Brash some information prior to the leadership vote, and which he put, my only concern is that National MPs will see you as narrowing the party's appeal, not widening, and then attached as a paper with the suggestion of what you might send to MPs to overcome this problem. And at the top of the paper was one word, race.
Well, I haven't caught up with that. That surprises me a little. I wouldn't have thought that was...
Was that the Roger Douglas you know?
No, it wasn't. The Roger Douglas I knew was a more tolerant and open person. Now, I haven't read the memo, so I don't know what its content is. The fact that he offered the advice, well, I think that's his prerogative. If it was accepted, well, that's Don Brash's choice as well.
But you said you've known Don Brash for a while, though, so has he always been keen on the getting rid of the Māori seats?
I've not discussed that specifically with him in that way, but the Don Brash I've known for a long time has been a very open, tolerant and liberal individual, and someone who does have a world view that is beyond the sort of the narrow and the precious. I can't say that that goes for all in his party, and it may well be that other influences are shaping his positions at the moment. But I think that Don has always, I mean, to me, he's always been a pretty high-minded and a noble individual.
Okay. The Greens, is it possible, I mean, could you work with them at all? I mean, I didn't see the being that, you were with Jeanette and
Chad. There are some issues we have common ground on. We have common ground, as it turns out, by coincidence, on our policy on student loan repayments, and equally on having a free annual health check for all citizens. So I have no difficulty working with the Greens on issues we have in common, in the sense that I've got no difficulty working with anyone on issues we have in common. But what gets me about the Greens is their sort of sanctimonious approach to the world, that because they care for the environment, that everyone else that doesn't see it their way is somehow a lesser being. Their attitudes, I think, are purist, idealistic and unworkable. And I think that having them near government, this is not personal to them, but having parties with those philosophies near government will scare international investors, will make New Zealand a laughingstock and will take us backwards. And I just don't have that aspiration for this country.
Because you mentioned that Nigel Tansh, you know, it was a joke that he would be Attorney General. He won't even be in Cabinet. He's like number 8 on their list.
Well, he's number 7, I think. But I think people do need to start and think about that. I use him as an example. I think there are more serious contenders. I mean, there has been the spectre of Jeanette Fitzsimons as Minister of Energy, and I think that that is something that New Zealanders would be concerned about, particularly in industry. Rod Donald has got an economic interest. He's vehemently anti-free trade. This is a small trading nation that survives on its ability to trade and enter into agreements with other countries. I think some issues arise there. Keith Lock, who's supported every known terrorist cause on earth, in a foreign affairs role.
Keith might take exception with that, but let's just go back to it. I mean, really, Rod Donald's unlikely to be Minister of Free Trade, and Jeanette Fitzsimons does have an interest in energy.
Well, it depends what deal they negotiate. I mean, I don't know. I think these are issues that people need to think about.
If they were in positions which, like, say, Jeanette Fitzsimons did something with conservation and Rod Donald did something with his interest in economic development that had nothing to do with free trade, and then why would it be so hard to work with them if they weren't clashing? I mean, why would it be so hard?
It depends on what the issues are, frankly. And I must say, one of the things that amazes me is that Helen Clark is a remarkably cautious and risk-averse person. And I'm surprised that she is allowing herself to be put in a position where she is embracing, or seemed to be embracing, the Greens, because I don't think, in fact, I know from conversations with her what her views about them are, and I don't think that she's at all comfortable at the prospect of having to work with them.
Well, the one thing though is the Greens have said, we're definitely going with Labour.
Mm.
And you've said, well, I'm not sure, I can't, we'll have to wait till the election. Do you think that gives them a bargaining chip?
No, it doesn't. They've got nowhere else to go. What I'm saying is that the role of politicians, and particularly smaller parties in this, is not to try and jack up the election result. Our role is to work with the cards that the public deal on election day. And if you back yourself into the corner of saying, I'll only work with these people on these terms or those people on those terms, you're effectively screwing the scrum. What we're saying is people vote, the choices become obvious, we then look at the outcome and say, okay, where do we fit in this scenario? Can we work with the players that look likely to be able to put a government together? That's a far more reasonable and responsible position. It's not about avoiding the issue. It's saying, let the public have their say, and then we work with the public's decision.
But a lot of the public might say, well, we want to vote for Labour, so we'll vote for the Greens because they'll work with Labour, or alternatively, we'll vote for ACT because they'll support
National. I think that's the problem. I think a lot of people who might want to vote for Labour or National become worried by the fact that out to their flanks are parties that have more extreme positions than them. By contrast, United Future brings them back towards the centre. And I think there's a lot of people on the fringes of those major parties that say, I'd quite like to see the National Party in office, but I actually don't agree with the ACT philosophy. So United Future is a convenient repository for my vote. Equally, Labour voters, Conservative Labour voters, who quite like to see the Labour Party in power, but don't want to see it having to work with the Greens.
Now, how do those people feel, though, on election? Like, how did the people that voted for United Future feel when you went with Labour after the last election? If they wanted to see National?
Well, according to the opinion polls, I think from memory 60% of them said we made the correct call going with Labour. Curiously, what there was opposition to was the fact that we hadn't entered a formal coalition, that we'd only done a confidence and supply agreement. So I think it depends on the circumstances at the time. We made the right call in 2002. The question that we now have to consider is what the circumstances are in 2005 and what our call will be.
Okay, and just on that, you weren't in a formal coalition.
No.
So this time around, your MPs are more experienced.
Yeah.
Who can you see working well in cabinet?
I don't want to name individuals because I think my problem is if I have to pick people to go into a cabinet, it's not who the hell do I pick, it's who the hell do I leave out. I think that you can look at each one of our MPs who has distinguished themselves in their portfolio areas, and you could say there is someone who could do the job that we would want them to do. I've got no qualms on that score, but if I had to pick...
Mark Alexander, for example, he's an eager beaver on law and order.
Yeah, well,
could you see him working?
Yeah, Gordon Copeland, Mark Alexander, Judy Turner, Larry Baldock, Murray Smith, Bernie Ogilvie. They're all people who've made a contribution. They're all people who could easily slot into a role in their particular area. It's not a question of scratching them sort of around and thinking, who the hell could we put forward for this? I think that one of the things that these MPs have shown over the last 3 years is that they've got to grips with the job, and the fact that that in some areas, you've mentioned Mark Alexander, I mean, Judy Turner's another one, Gordon Copeland's another, Larry Baldock's another, people actually see them as being already people of stature in those portfolio areas. That's a terrific achievement.
The MP at National told me, he said, there is difficulty with personalities on the centre-right, but United Future people, they're okay, we don't mind them. Does that sort of feel around the behind?
I think that's true. I think that that we've earned our spurs. We came in at the last election with a lot of people wondering what on earth had happened, and some MPs who were very surprised to be here. But I think 3 years down the track, there's more than grudging respect for what we've done and for the capabilities of those individuals.
Now, just the Wing Party, I noticed that the pro-smoking party, they came to go with United Future. What's the deal?
Well, what's happened, there's no deal. The Wing Party, I think, still legally exists. They've withdrawn from this year's election, and John Van Buren, who's their leader, has joined United Future and has been selected as our candidate for the Christchurch Central seat.
Down for the party vote, not in the top 10 votes.
No, he's not on the party list. He was selected after the list nominations closed, so he's going for the party vote. And the thing that's driving him and his supporters is our opposition to petty rules, all sorts of imposition on people's lives. It's not the smoking thing per se, although that's his obviously main area of interest, but it's the sort of the red tape, the rules, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, I just want to wrap up by talking with about working for families. What parts of working for families do United Future support?
Well, we were involved in the design of Working for Families virtually from the beginning. We talked very closely with Michael Cullen all the way through it. And one of the things we were proudest of was that the ceiling in terms of income is much higher than was initially intended, because we wanted to make sure that middle-income families benefited as well. And I think if you go back to 2004, the budget last year, Michael kind of made the point that the ceiling was much higher directly as a result of United Futures intervention. We made it clear all the way through that rather than doing this by income maintenance means, we would have preferred it to have been done directly through the tax system. We made no secret about that.
Yeah.
But we also said we weren't going to sort of stymie the package on a point of principle like that. We felt that people needed the money, and we weren't going to say no unless it comes through this channel. We're not going to give anyone anything.
But Working for Families is, it's in Australia, it's overseas. Some people say, it's making us all welfare recipients.
I think it's a bit of rhetoric, but I can see where that argument comes from. As I say, we would have far preferred the mechanisms to be tax based, and rather than income support based. But we were not that churlish to say to people, well, because we have that preference, we're going to deny you any material lift in your circumstances. Our own policy makes it clear we would like to move to tax-based changes rather than income support mechanisms in the out years for Working for Families. But the idea of putting in place a package that's going to benefit, in excess of 300,000 New Zealand families, which is the biggest package ever, we think is great, and we're very pleased to have been involved with it.
Gordon, can you just explain the income splitting thing? I didn't quite get it. Gordon Copeland was talking about with National would go up to 100,000, so a family would be eligible for 200,000. What's the meaning there?
He's made some calculations based on National shift in tax thresholds. Essentially, income splitting means that if you take the current position, the most beneficial, the time at which the benefit ceases to be dramatic, is once you hit two incomes of $60,000, because that's the top.
It'll go up to 100,000 under National.
Under the National scheme, I think instead of being at $120,000, which effectively is at the moment being sort of the cut-off point, I think under the National scheme, as they push the thresholds out, it'll be $200,000. And that was really the point that he was making, is that would benefit more families further on. I must say,
would they really need it though?
Well, I was going to say that when you're getting up to those levels, even at 60 and 60 combined income of 120, the benefit from income splitting is far less than if you've got a family where, say, one partner's earning 60,000 and the other's earning 10,000. So it's a bit of an academic argument, because the real crunch comes in terms of the benefit to families a little lower down the income scale. But the point that he was making is that the benefit would, the range is extended by pushing the thresholds out a little bit further.
Sure, and also you're going to have tax cuts for not just families, for single people.
What our policy proposes is a tax-free threshold of $3,000 for all income earners, and that includes superannuitants, because they're deemed to be income earners, part-time as well as full-time, which is good for students in particular. Shifting the tax brackets by a far more modest amount than the National Party has initially, $5,000 in each bracket, and indexing that, which of itself produces some significant tax benefits for all income earners, but income splitting then comes in on top of that for parents with dependent children.
Sure. Thank you very much. And just finally, though, TV3, how are you dealing with them these days? Has the relationship improved?
Well, the relationship was always reasonably good. There hasn't been much contact since the debate, actually. They were very warm and friendly when I arrived that night, and that was fine. We just got on with it. So there's no ill feelings on my part.
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.